Tous les garçons et les filles de mon âge se promènent dans la rue de par deux. Tous les garçons et les filles de mon âge savent bien ce que c'est qu'être heureux. Et les yeux dans les yeux, et la main dans la main, ils s'en vont. Par les rues, l'âme en peine, oui mais moi, je vais seul, car personne ne m'aime.
150, here we go. Cue the fanfare. The ticker tape parade has come and gone. It wasn't for us. It was for something else. We just piggybacked off of it.
We were just wanting to see what all the what it was all about.
Right.
The music and saw the ticker tape and I love fluttering things.
I'm easily distracted. Ladies and gentlemen, Hey Kids Comics has returned from a brief hiatus to bring you the fetally legendary, we'll see if it's actually legendary, issue 150. We are excited. I am Andrew Farmer, your host, as always. With me, my co-host, producer, and magna cum laude, graduate of comic sciences, the Jedi, Cole Houston, is with me, as always.
Good evening, and I couldn't be happier, because we are hitting this amazing milestone.
Oof.
That really just 150 issues.
It's insane. It's insane.
How did this happen?
I don't know how. And we still have every intention of doing Best Comic I Ever Read again. Life got in the way of doing a bunch of interviews with people, which we still are going to do and have done a few. But tonight, we're going to do something that we've done in the past, but we haven't revisited in a while.
And I do want to point out, contact us at
right.
jcumail@yahoo.com if you want to get in on that. Pitch the best comic you ever read, and we might be in contact with you.
I'm tired of accosting people at Starbucks and various grocery stores, just asking them.
Oh, and grabbing them Batman style. What's the best comic you ever read?
What's the best comic you ever read?
You ever read?
I really want to do Bat Manager.
Nuts.
You're right. Family Circus?
Wrong.
Knock them out, just right there.
The city. Oh wait, wrong.
Right, same 6-1. Really, when you get down to it. So we are here to do issue 150, best comic we ever read. We have a few
comics
of them. Yeah, we have a few. So it's comics we've ever read.
And this will also spare you when we do. We're actually upcoming in October. We will be premiering Hey Kids Comics Quarterly.
There you go.
And Hey Kids Comics Quarterly, we're going to launch a brand new vehicle every, 3 months? Is it?
About three,
every
yeah.
3 months, you'll get a brand new Hey Kids Comics Quarterly. And the concept is that these are going to be the things the way comics used to be, where you had a story that was too big to fit in one issue.
Right.
And you didn't want to do it in, like, two issues for reasons.
For reasons. And these certainly aren't story arcs that we're talking about. These are single encapsulated ideas that are just too big for...
Absolutely.
Right.
And since we really didn't want to repeat ourselves with our annual by having, like, another annual of the same, what we've decided to go with is let the quarterly be the vehicle through which we bring back Hey Kids Comics, or Hey Kids Comics, the best comic I ever read. So that is coming up in Hey Kids Comics, or HKC Quarterly, number one.
In October. Very nice.
Number two will be a very unique personal journey in the realm of none other than Marvel Comics.
I can't wait. And you guys shouldn't be able to wait either. That's all I'm saying.
It's going to be pretty big. We're hoping to line up some guests for that, because it's a story that needs to be told in the oral tradition of our ancestors.
And it really, here's my thing about that, and we're not going to dwell on it too much, but it hasn't. that's the thing. You say it needs to be told, it does. But the funny thing, the thing that I am most amazed about is that it hasn't been told. Like, you can't find very much information on it. So I think
absolutely.
We'll be doing
this should have been the biggest fanboy outrage, and yet never was.
It fell right in that perfect epoch. You know, it's how the woolly mammoth survived as long as it did. It's how the coelacanth still walks the earth today, where it fell right in between the end of kind of where we were coming to the end of print coverage in comics and the beginning of internet coverage in comics, kind of right in that gap. So
that's so true.
Yeah, and I think that's probably why. All right, but that's all in the future. Let's focus on the now. And the now, we're going to talk about some of the best comics we've ever read. We promise you we will not talk about Watchmen, I don't think, at least not in a serious fashion.
I think I've gone on record as saying, in the context of the best comic I've ever read, or comics as time goes on, enough is said on a regular basis. There are literally tens of hours of content. I would wager to say there's close to 25 hours.
Easy, yeah.
If you combined any mention made or the points where I'm just waxing nonstop. So I've long ago decided Watchmen was recused from consideration.
Yeah.
For no other reason than it gets enough bloody coverage as it stands. So.
Right, and you know, we're not. You know, there's certain comics that are off limits, and I promise you, I personally promise you, there will be no mention of Iron Fist from me, at least. The last one we did of this was very, very Kung Lung heavy. So I'm going to back off of the Iron Fist in as far as the tonight goes. But Cole, let's bring it around. Like, the idea is that these are encapsulated stories, whether they be story arcs or just single shot stories that we've read that we feel, for whatever reason, are the best we've ever read.
Precisely, and in the context of the larger best comic I ever read, the individual interviews, we're opening up. If it's an entire series, blew you away. That is certainly fair game. But for our purposes tonight, or this morning, depending on what time of day you're listening, we are looking at our own, just an individual story or story arc that really struck a chord.
Right. So why don't you get us started with something, Cole? Okay. I'm unaware of what Cole's going to say, by the way. I'm completely in the dark. This will be interesting.
Well, I wanted to touch on, I recently discovered that I'm doing something I'm very famous for doing, and that is rebuying things I already have.
Yeah.
And most recently, I've discovered that I have not once, not twice, not thrice, but four times. I feel like I'm in a funny thing happened on the way to the forum.
Or something. I was going to say, is this a Monty Python?
just waiting for Zero Mostel to come in. But four distinct times, I have purchased at least twice a volume of Fables trade paperback. Thinking, eventually, the nice thing is there are a finite number of these. The story runs its course, I was pleased to discover, because I've spent far too much money rebuying the same damn trades, which means that my goal of reading them in order is constantly hamstrung by my own inability to maintain even so much as an analog paper database from which to derive when the rare occasion I come across one at a half price books or on sale at a convention, which ones do I need to buy? I should start buying backward because I'm never going to get there otherwise.
Right.
But in lieu of trying to achieve the goal of reading them all in order, I did read one that I thought that I had read, and either I forgot more than I realized, or I had not read as much as I thought, or perhaps just read individual issues. And this is, of course, the Vertigo series Fables.
Yes.
The essentially that from which Disney invoking public domain and having the full command of their version of public domain.
Right.
Pretty much trumped this property from ever being developed.
Right.
With their happily ever after, whatever the hell that piece of garbage. If you like that, if you love that show, I insist you seek out Fables. Look for Legends in Exile, which is Volume 1. Animal Farm is Volume 2. Storybook Love, Volume 3. Get at least the first couple, or just the first one. You will be hooked. And you will see someone who long, long before Once Upon a Time took that concept and made it far more sensible and far more fulfilling. And the thing is, as you move through the story arcs, things that were introduced in the first story arc become powerfully relevant.
Right.
In story arc 5 or 9 or 11. And, you know, I get chills talking about that fact because it's such an amazing feeling to read something that has that much forethought.
So, what about...
And... I guess all of this was building, in a way, to the volume I just recently
read. Oh, okay.
Which was Volume 10, The Good Prince. This is a collection that reprints Fables number 60 through 69. And essentially there's a character that's introduced even in the first issue, I think, of the series, known as Flycatcher. And I remember when I was first introduced to Fables, not really catching on, as it were, who Flycatcher was. That he's essentially the Frog Prince.
Okay.
Of legend. So hence the him having a penchant for eating flies.
Yeah.
And you have this character who's been kind of a comic relief or background or the wingman sidekick buddy picture,
right,
character. But he's always kind of the, I don't know, like Zach Galifianakis in the Hangover movies. You know, he's an important part, but he's not the main character.
He's kind of Danny Glover, Lethal Weapon.
Exactly. Yeah, he's there, but he's not at the forefront.
Right.
He's not the one like busting guys in the Christmas tree farm.
Lethal Weapon reference. Hey, issue 150. Lethal Weapon reference.
First Lethal Weapon. 150 issues in. I finally got one. All right.
And a good one too.
Oh, I am getting too old for this.
No. Oh, God, yeah. Keep your powder dry, buddy. There's 150 more of these to go at least. So.
That's right. So, but essentially, what is beautiful about this particular story? It does what Fables does best, and that's occasionally in the heart of a really big story, it takes an issue off.
Yeah.
And in this case, it does that, but it's a fun little story about some of the other characters and their family life. But essentially, if you're not familiar with Fables, and if the complaint about Happily Ever After didn't cue you in... Fables is a series I often refer to as the only thing Billy Willingham ever finished.
Chili Willingham, yeah.
And he continued to finish it, and apparently finished it completely. But this is a master storyteller at the height of his craft. It is such a brilliantly researched use of myth, not myth so much as folklore and legend. And weaving all of these elements together because they are public domain.
Right.
I do have it on good authority that there's going to be a special called Fables Happy Birthday Special, because that is now thankfully public domain.
Nice.
I had to be a little topical there. But the reality is that what Willingham does with the Fables series is create this idea that all of the old fairy tales were sort of willed into existence in their own separate worlds until some great, mighty, terrible entity comes and takes them over one at a time.
Right.
And just runs roughshod. And in the wake of, or in the forefront of this assault are exiles from each of these realms, all just being pushed further and further and further away until they come somehow into our world.
Right, they become expatriates. Yeah,
so, and so you have this whole very rich community of characters like Snow White and Cinderella and the Big Bad Wolf, the Three Little Pigs. Apparently, if you were of any note, your chances of getting out were great. I mean,
right.
Nobody, you know, some minor little nursery rhyme characters have gone largely unmentioned. But all the notables seem to have survived quite smartly. Pinocchio, and, you know, but you, if you imagine like your Grimm fairy tales, your Mother Goose, your and even to the point of folding in more modern fables, if you will, like the works of Rudyard Kipling.
Yes.
Which were largely based on some of the folklore of India where he was living. But in this particular story, not to continue to wind off the path, it's far too easy to do, you have the character of Flycatcher, the Frog Prince, Ambrose, finally coming of his own in the series in a beautiful, brilliant, very self-sacrificing way. And you're brought up to the very edge of disaster, and everything turns around. And leading into this, the fable community, it's just a, you know, just this crap storm of disaster and terrible, you know, things just, when things can't seem to get any worse, they do just that.
Yeah.
And there's so much of that, that this is really one of those wonderful, there's a handful of little turning points as you get into the 8, 9, and 10, volumes 8, 9, and 10, where the tide begins to turn. And they really start giving their enemy a run for his money. And it's, this one, I don't want to give away too much, but it's a really fun, touching story. It works best, of course, if you're very familiar with the characters, because you've come to love them. And you see just the capacity of this character, his nobility, that was sort of understated for so long, and that you've forgotten that he was royalty.
You forgot he was important. You forgot, yeah.
Forgot he was supposed to be someone of importance. And it's a very cathartic tale for the character, a tremendous shot at redemption, and becoming, you know, rising to the pinnacle, yet never losing sight of who he was.
Right.
And that is what makes this such a wonderfully engaging, endearing tale. You know, with what you, having a foreknowledge, you could go right into this and enjoy it. In much the same way, I'm probably the only person who wasn't disappointed with the final episode of Lost, because I've never seen a single episode of Lost.
Right.
And I absolutely loved the final episode. I saw most of it. I kind of came in late, but I was very moved. I thought this was wonderful, but I didn't have, you know, years of building to something, anticipation of something I wasn't getting.
Right, right.
So, you know, I think if you haven't ever seen Lost, just watch the last episode.
There you go. Did
you could go into it with in the same way, and still enjoy it, but it's even more fulfilling when you're very familiar and you love these characters so much.
Do you think, because so many of these, and I look at books like Starman and Fables, and not to invoke it, but even books like Watchmen and a lot of the works of Alan Moore, and to a lesser extent Frank Miller when he's doing limited run stuff, as sort of like the British idea of the series, where it's, you know, each season they call them series, and you have a finite. You know, you have a finite beginning and a finite end, and that's what you're going to do. do you think that Fables ever jumped? Is there a point at which you think it jumped the shark and righted the ship, or has it just been solid all the way through?
Of everything I have read, it has remained solid. There are points where, with gaps in what I have at my disposal, I don't really know how they got to a certain point. I was afraid, honestly, when you, now that you mentioned that, I was afraid when they spun off Jack of Fables.
Yes.
Which is, the character is Jack Horner, who is, you know, little Jack Horner of the nursery rhyme. He is Jack the Giant Killer. He's Jack and the Beanstalk, Jack be Nimble. Any Jack that ever occurred in any nursery rhyme or folklore is embodied in this one character. Mm-hmm. And he's a great principal character who is just the consummate schemer.
Right.
And I was afraid that Jack of Fables was, you know, a little bit more literally letting their hair down. Because it when you jump away from your core story and you start to concentrate on one character, things can really go bad. But once I started buying the trade paperbacks of that, the Jack of Fables just enhances the story because it takes you outside of the particular story arc, the particular ongoing saga, and it's like spinning off a second series in that same sort of British way. It has I have an inkling that that's going somewhere as well.
Nice.
That it's going to tell its own story because it does constantly evolve. And there are some points where the two touch. In fact, one of the trade paperbacks is known as the Great Fables Crossover because they did crossover issues between the two.
Nice. That's awesome, man.
As part of, you know, drawing a greater story together.
Right.
Does explain how these entities are kind of literally willed into existence in the first place.
That's cool.
So, yeah, I highly recommend the entire Fable series. As I said, I have not finished it yet. But you do bring a good point of about that sort of very British idea of a series. And in the cases of some of the better miniseries that we know of, the best miniseries are the ones that treat themselves that way. Like, I've got a story to tell, and then it will be over. And then you have the series that go beyond a quote-unquote maxi series like Starman or Fables, where the joy is in discovering there was a plan all along.
Right.
And to me, that was like the only British series I can think of was a British comedy called The Good Neighbors.
Okay.
Which played out like any given sitcom in the U.S., but with that very British kind of flair. And ran for, you know, I couldn't tell how many seasons or how many episodes. Yeah. It was a good, long series. I mean, we used to watch it for years. And it actually had a final episode.
Yeah.
It was like the entire story was building toward that.
Well, not to
it's on a turning point.
Not to take this on a too far of a tangent, but I was listening to an interview with the guy that that created IT Crowd. And he was saying that those things are possible in the UK because they don't have the pack writer mentality. You don't have a writer's room. The person who writes the show is the person who writes the show.
That is so true. Very often, yeah, you'll see, like The Good Neighbors. I think it was like you would have a show and it would say by somebody.
That's it. Yeah, and so they have that story in their head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the point.
So with yours, you took the world of the fantastic and they managed to mold it into the world of the mundane, and that's what makes it so amazing, is that you have these fantastic characters that survive and live among us unbeknownst to us.
Yeah, and that's a good the way you put that, it was very appropriate because one of the fun things about this particular tale, because of Flycatcher, he becomes, so many of these characters become so much a part of their integration into our world because they've been there for centuries. And what's fun is when he returns home in the storyline, late into the story, when they're able to at least, you know, breathe a while between strife.
Right.
He here he is, you know, the king, the head of this little kingdom that he's forging, and he really wants nothing more than to go out and play, have softball games.
Right.
And you have this wonderful scene of some of the humans and non-human characters, like these goblins that are prevalent throughout the series, who've come over to his side, and they're having a big softball game, like, you know, you might see anywhere in the U.S.
See, and what I did was I went the opposite direction, where what I feel that comic books do really well, and we've talked about this before, is take mundane, what we would consider mundane issues, and apply the bombacity of comics to them. So my first choice for the evening is of all things, Moon Knight. I didn't say I wasn't going to talk about Moon Knight. I did say
That's
I wasn't
true.
Going to talk about Iron
you
Fist.
You said there were things you wouldn't talk about, but that it was not. But it was a short list.
But during the rebirth, kind of the reinstatement of all the Marvel Knights type characters, where you had the new Daredevil and the new Punisher, and they were really stripping them down and going back to like the bare bones, street level stuff. They took Moon Knight and went a different direction with him, and they sent him back to L.A. So they sent Moon Knight back to, and this is Moon Knight. They call it Volume 3, but it's the series that Bendis and Maliev drew, but Bendis wrote. And you know, I do like Bendis for all of his Talking Head stuff that I'll rib him for. I do like the work of Bendis. The cool thing about this was, so he gets out to L.A. As a secret, he's selling his life story, but he's actually out there undercover, being sent out there by various, like, the Avengers to uncover this this crime syndicate that has a functioning head of Ultron, of all things, right? So, but throughout the first, and I'm only really talking about the first four issues, okay? This thing went on for 2 years, but the first four issues that you can pick up in trade, which is issues 1 through 6, is the first trade. He gets out there, and he's conferring with Cap and Wolverine and Spider-Man and these kind of high level at the time ranking Avengers, right? So they'll have Cap or Spider-Man will show up on his balcony, and he'll go out there and have these conversations about what's going on, and then you know, Spider-Man will swing off, or you know, Cap will get on a Quinjet or something and fly off. And then he goes out and fights crime, and he fights Bullseye, and it's a pretty cool fight. You know, like they have some cool, the art is good, the story writing is pretty cool. But at some point you start to get the inkling that Cap, Wolverine, Spider-Man, these guys aren't there. These guys are in Mark's head. And it's revealed that it's all schizophrenic episodes, because Mark Spector's crazy and they let it go for so long, but they weave it into the story so well that, and I know I'm spoiling it, but I don't care because it still works, that for the first three issues, you think that this is what's happening. You think that he's out there, you know, being sanctioned by the Avengers to go out there and do this. And it's eventually revealed to you that it's all schizophrenic episodes, that these guys aren't there, that he's talking to himself, that you know, and eventually he meets up with Echo while he's out there, who is the deaf, kind of the ninja character that was trained by the hand, or trained by Stick, and they bring down the crime syndicate, and then, you know, life continues for Moon Knight. But life continues in these weird schizophrenic episodes throughout the thing. So the reason I say that it takes kind of the mundane and applies that pastiche of bombacity to it is because, you know, we're dealing with mental illness in comics. And when we talked about it before, I don't even know, I think we might have mentioned Mark Spector, but dude is crazy. And they do it so well in this. They really paint this picture of a guy that's on a mission. You know, and he's got this front, kind of this Batman-like front, where he's doing interviews for TV shows about his life story, not as Moon Knight, but as Mark Spector, you know, because he was a mercenary that then, you know, became rich and a philanthropist and a business owner, and in the behind the scenes, he's working with this team of Avengers to bring this down, which is actually just these different aspects of himself that
yeah,
are...
Yeah, it's
that
just
are,
him justifying, self-justifying, or self...
Yes, Yeah, and these different aspects, like when he needs, like when he needs to be told that he's doing the right thing, Cap is there.
Yeah, okay. Yes.
When he needs to get feral and mean and down and dirty, you know, Wolverine shows up. Or when he needs to, you know, when there needs to be some sort of levity or comic relief or something, because stuff's gotten real too serious, Spider-Man shows up, you know, and the whole time you're thinking it's just comic book. This is what happens in comic books, right? Like, the guys show up, and then they talk, and then they leave, and then he does his job. This is just crossover stuff, because it's the first issues of a comic. You know, they're going to bring in these guys to bump up the sales, and it's cool, because you get to see your favorites, in it, but you get to see Moon Knight, you know, interact. In a way that he hasn't since Civil War, so that's cool. And then all of a sudden you're like, wait, holy shit. You see, he's not even, these guys aren't. And I absolutely loved it as a character study on this guy. Like, what motivates him? Who does he see when he gets crazy? He sees Cap. He sees Spider-Man. These are the guys that he apparently, you know, subconsciously looks up to.
Yeah, he sees who he needs to see.
Yeah, and it was really, really cool. So in short order, from about 2010, the first six issues in trade paperback are available. They're also available in single issues. You know, and it's also a returning to roots, because Moon Knight started as an Avenger, really, in West Coast Avengers. That's when he really got his big play. So it's sort of a returning to roots for that as well. I absolutely love it. I think it's great. It's one of those only could exist in Marvel Comics, or in comic books in general situations, played really well. It's a very smart book. So Moon Knight, starting in 2010. That's choice uno for me. I absolutely loved it.
Well, you know, what's fascinating about that is it's very easy to take the idea of schizophrenia and write it dumb.
Right.
You know, that someone, there's kind of a thoughtfulness to taking the approach that was taken and revealing, taking that very subtle kind of, you know, you're not like, oh, look, Moon Knight's all crazy. It's sort of, like you said, you're getting the things you're expecting.
Right.
You expect that Moon Knight is going to work with the Avengers, because he is one.
Right.
And to suddenly discover, I can't always necessarily be certain.
Yes.
If
yes.
He's working with them or not, because it's just been, it's sort of been, it plays with the kind of the natural assumptions that one makes, you know, when you're confronted with those sorts of scenes. It's sort of a built-in, you know, if Wolverine's there, then Wolverine's there. You're not half expecting that to be just in someone's head, and what
right.
You're getting is more their point of view than the, you know, in the moment reality.
And the other side to that is that they don't also break the other cardinal sin that comic books always do, which is write it too serious, which is to make it this like they've done in. They've done it in Moon Knight, actually. Like, the series, you know, in between this one and the one, or I think it was actually right before this one, they really approached his crazy as super serious and really dark, and it didn't play well. You know, it just doesn't. This isn't Frank Miller. This isn't Alan Moore. You know, this is an Avenger. Don't take it down that road. And they didn't break that cardinal rule either, and they kept it light. You know, they kept the idea light and very comic booky, which was something that is hard to come by, you know, without getting too serious.
Well, also what's nice there is, it seems to me from what you were saying, that you have the reveal ultimately. But once revealed, it doesn't just go away.
Right.
So, you know, it becomes sort of like a magic trick that doesn't, you know, that doesn't necessarily have to end upon the...
Right, upon the, what's the three
prestige.
Rules? That, thank you, upon the prestige, yes. Yes.
But it's almost like a Penn and Teller, where you... you not only do the trick, but then you reveal how you did the trick, and then you do the trick again in a different way that you can't figure out how it was done.
Right. Right.
So you get all of those elements, and I think that's what makes, that's the joy of watching something. Why would anyone pay money to go see a magician? You know what's coming. It's all in the approach.
Right.
And what this does is throw that idea on, kind of turns it on its ear, because you kind of know what's coming in a superhero comic. He's going to go out, he's going to fight crime, But to give it a very psychological inside twist like that.
Right.
It's like, it's almost an M. Night Shyamalan with a twist.
It kind of was, actually. And the cool thing was, after the fact, he's acknowledging that, it's revealed to him, and he's acknowledging the fact that they're delusions. But Wolverine's basically saying stuff like, whatever gets you through the night, bub, and just still there, yeah. I'm not going anywhere, so you better get used to me type of situation. And they really do kind of work with the paradigm some, and it's very cool. It's a very interesting I'll call it a character study, but it's very Bendis later Matt Fraction Iron Man type work, and I really did like it. So that's what I've got. Cole, you got any more for us?
Absolutely. I was struggling a bit because there were some ideas I had, some memories. I was actually turned out to be folding the two comics into one. We discussed this a little bit.
Inception.
This knowing laugh here is because we discussed this a little bit, as we were in chambers before the show.
That's right.
A lot of people don't realize we had chambers.
We held a quorum.
That's right. Before each show, we have to attend to things in that way. But I was combining two different distinct Batman stories into one, because both of them had one thing in common, and that was really being engaging stories that I just sort of, picked up, I'll just pick up a Batman for the hell of it, and being very wowed by a particular story, and then going back and trying to follow up, when I finally got a chance to try to dig up the next issue. And what I got was not anything remotely like what I was looking for.
Yeah.
It was like, what happened to the story I was reading? And luckily, before the show, I was able to do a little research, and I stumbled on exactly what I was looking for. And did confirm that I was folding two different, entirely different issues of things together into one, because they each had that same sort of feel to them, and then promptly went away. I did finally make peace with my first one, and that was, I remember this issue of Batman I was reading, which was just basically a very, what am I thinking of? Famous Batman artist who, at any rate.
Was it Neil Adams? Who did it?
Yes, a very Neil Adams-esque cover. It was actually probably not at all by Neil Adams, but it kind of puts you in the mind of the way Neil Adams draws Batman.
Right.
Except it's fingery. Neil Adams has this way of just Batman gains extra knuckles. But this was Batman number 364, Batman volume 1, 364. And way back when comics were 60-cent cover price. And it was just Batman superimposed over this sea of various faces, saying, who is he? What is he? And I think, if there was a way I could figure out how to do the research on how often the who is he, what is he theme has appeared on comic covers.
Right.
I think we could do a who is he, what is he issue, but that would take a lot of research.
We're doing it. I'm putting it on the table. We're doing it.
But it just said that, and then simply Chimera. Like some sort of 70s cop show. It's Chimera.
It's Chimera.
Chimera, get in here!
Do you know how much damage you did to the...
It's Chimera, Chief.
Chimera does what Chimera has to do.
That's right. I'm a force of nature.
I'm a force of nature!
Chimera, he's a force of nature.
Reap the whirlwind.
back to the topic at hand here on Hey Kids Comics. This was an issue of Batman where it was what was cool about this was it was a neat little Jason Todd story, because it allowed, what I like is when you get a chance to get a little insider kind of story, like we talked about on that one ish on the dating a superhero about the Beast Boy getting to shine in the wedding of Donna Troy.
Right.
And this was an opportunity where, you know, you expect Robin's going to go out and fight crime with Batman. You expect Robin's going to get kidnapped and have to be rescued or any number of things. What you don't usually get to see is what's going on in Robin's head. What's Robin up to? And Batman ultimately, I had to kind of read the synopsis because it's been a while. I'd forgotten about it. He kind of goes undercover to follow up on something that Robin's been researching. And he kind of stumbles on Robin's dossier as he's putting together his... and it was one of those fun things because Robin gets to play detective. Jason Todd's playing detective.
Right.
And he's working out there like these strings of crime burglaries that go on, you know, periodically in Gotham. And somehow he's worked out that they happen in other cities. So it's almost like these same serial crimes are just sort of traveling around like, I'm a circus. And so, you know, the investigation leads to just that, a circus. And a character becomes known as the Chimera. What's neat is the Chimera is essentially a mythological beast that was a combo beast. It was made up of a lion, a goat, and a snake, or dragon, depending on whose version you prefer. But the idea of the Chimera is being multiple things at once, to the point where chimeric describes things where you have, like, in people, they've discovered that it's possible for people to be chimeric and have two sets of DNA.
Right.
Which is bizarre, because it essentially is like a completely engulfed and conjoined twin.
Right. On a molecular level, right?
Yeah, I talk about schizophrenic, but on a molecular level. at any rate, that wasn't pre-planned, by the way, folks.
Between
Batman undercover and Jason Todd as Robin, they're able to work out that these burglaries are all being perpetrated by someone who is with the circus, and they're thereby, you know, traveling around with the circus, and while everybody's at the circus, he's back at their house robbing them blind.
Right. Not too bad, actually. I mean,
it's a clever crime. It's simplistic in some respects, but it's very well played here. And like I said, the fun thing about this, what made it such a good, solid read, was that it really explored the budding, you know, the young Robin taking his cues from his mentor and, you know, becoming the Robin he would become to a point. Blowed up and brought back as a Red Hood, apparently.
Right.
Bucky kind of went. Get blown up, you come back evil.
That's the way it works. If we've learned one thing from comics, it's you get blown up, right. You come back evil.
So the problem is that I read this, Batman 364, and so then I thought, oh, this is really, I want to see, you know, this obviously isn't going to be a long running thing. So I go find Batman 365. and Batman 365 has absolutely zero to do with this story.
Just nothing. Just not at all.
Absolutely nothing. Batman's in Guatemala or somewhere. Yeah, he actually goes to Guatemala to rescue Vicky Vale from Incas and leopards.
And those things.
That sort of stuff. And I don't know if they were Incas in Guatemala, but, you know, it's just this, like, okay, did I not 1 month ago just read a story about Jason Todd and the circus and him doing some detective work? What happened?
Right.
Well, luckily my research tonight, I was able to get some closure to that. And discovered that the reason I couldn't find the second half of this story is it was continued in an issue of Detective Comics.
Of course it was.
Yes, we're aware. And, you know, back when Catherine and I had the comic shop, we used to have to warn people. For a while there, you know, post-John Byrne reboot of Superman, the Superman titles were getting to be really cool. And they were doing some fun stuff.
Right.
Within, you know, within those titles. And then all of a sudden, or what they started doing was they had four Superman titles, and you had story arcs that were crossing over all four. Shrewd move for DC, but when people were you know, coming in wanting recommendations at the shop, I would often say, I would love to recommend this stuff to you, but it's here is how you can tell. They had a little, thankfully had a little symbol on there that told you this is the year and this is the number of the sequencing.
Right.
So this would be like, you know, 19, or like, you know, 2001 or whatever it was. This was the 2001 story arc, part 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So, but, you know, unless we happen to have all those issues on hand, you might not be able to follow the story.
Right.
And I'm sure for collectors it made it difficult to know how they should go about arranging their collection. But I wasn't aware of that with this Batman, so as a result, I never have finished the second half of this best story. And the same was true for, I believe it was Batman 392. Well, they did it again. And it wasn't so much that this, I think this story actually ran its course. It's just that by the next issue, it was like it never happened.
Right. There was no reference at all. It was just done.
Well, I mean, within an issue or two, you went from, what I liked about this story, and the reason I recommend it, the Batman 392 is like literally the Batman-Catwoman date night.
No.
And it's a fun, it's titled A Night on the Town, and it's a fun little story where Batman, it's one of those periods in their on-again, off-again romance, where Batman and Catwoman have hooked up, they're trying to have a date night, and it's constantly interrupted by different crimes.
Right.
And there's a wonderful little scene where they go out and have a romantic dinner out behind an Italian restaurant because Batman and Catwoman can't exactly go walking in and, you know, you know, table for two, Tony. You know. You think the stuff in Goodfellas was you kind of Scorsese Steadicam thing if they're going to do that. But it's a fun little romantic bits and
right.
They're a little oft interrupted date night and then I wanted to say it was the next issue, but I can't seem to find where it happened. But you have this wonderful little romance going on, and then the very next issue, it seemed, it may well have been the next issue, it's like none of that ever happened. Batman and Catwoman are fighting. There's zero reference to the previous issue. There's zero indication the previous issue even happened. It almost like editorially And I may be wrong about it being the very next issue, but it probably was not much longer.
Yeah.
That everything shifted. I remember, you know, maybe going back at one point and wanting to see how that romance was progressing. And next thing you know, she's got the cat of nine tails out there keeping Batman at bay. And I don't know if maybe the this story was just too good or too touching, but someone at DC decided, no, Catwoman's a villain.
Right.
So they had this contrived story of Dr. Moon brainwashing her back into evil.
Really?
And it was just like, okay, you've gone from the pinnacle of storytelling to just the typical drivel.
Contrivanced, yeah. Gross.
And it was just a shame. But, you know, those two, I was trying to work out what the detective issue was that followed up Batman 364, but those are both really fun little just individual kind of standalone stories. And I'll eventually try to track down that detective so I can finish out the story there.
Right on. Well, that's cool, man. Yeah, no, you know, there's a thing that Batman comics sometimes try to do, and it's really hard to get right. And we've often talked about the fact that the alter ego to Bruce Wayne is Batman's alter ego, not the other way around. So it becomes really difficult to humanize Batman, you know, because he is this icon, he is this force, this almost emotion, you know, he becomes fear, he becomes vengeance. And then you have to figure out a way to humanize him to the readers. And it's a very difficult thing to do for a writer to take a humanize a god, essentially. It's really rough. And it's always nice to see that attempted and done well. So that's cool. So speaking of humanizing a god.
And especially, although the Catwoman date night, I think, really did ground Batman. It reminded you that there is a Bruce Wayne, that there is a man behind the suit.
Right. That even Batman has man in the title for a reason.
Exactly. And Cal has woman in the title.
There you go. When you boil it down, it's man and woman. Mine goes the opposite direction. Like and again, applying the bombacity of comics to a mundane situation, mine takes the humanization of what would be, you know, a comic book god to a different place. And I've mentioned this on the show twice, I think, maybe more, but there's another aspect that I wanted to talk about, and that is the Captain America Streets of Poison run, which runs 372 to 378 with the Daredevil issue mixed in there and a Streets of Poison one-shot. The reason, so when, you know, I got the book, I remember reading it when it came out. I had all the issues of it. I enjoyed it at the time. I was young. It didn't resonate with me the way it does now. So for those of you that don't understand what it is, there's this idea that Cap found Fabian, the guy that works on all the Quinjets, was high. And babbling in one day in the Quinjet hangar, and Cap's like, "What's wrong with you?" And he's like, this drug." And so he goes out to try to find this drug. Turns out through the story arc that it's actually the Red Skull producing this drug on the Kingpin's turf. So there's this turf war, which sets the backdrop to Cap being exposed to the drug, but because of his super soldier serum that's in his bloodstream, it bonds with it. So he experiences this constant high, this weird, constant paranoid state where he fights everyone. He fights Daredevil because Daredevil's trying to keep the man down, and he fights Diamondback, who at the time was his girlfriend. He fights Black Widow. He fights Crossbones. I think at one point he fights Bullseye. He fights just everybody. He ends up having dinner with Kingpin, like sitting next to him at, you know, a table and making these weird super I'm high, so I'm instantly bad. like awful. Like, yeah, he turns in like two issues into this like bad guy.
It sounds almost like sort of the thing where, you know, he's so high that everyone else can't help but buy into the high.
Right. It's this whole, like, idea of, it's almost like the comic book version of Reefer Madness, but yeah. There's two aspects of this that I wanted to really get into. One of them is the fact that, and this is what the comic book was aiming to do, okay? First of all, it was supposed to be the you know, the drug issue, the drug problem in America.
Yeah. Supposed to be that Mr. Mac drugs are bad.
Yeah, no, yeah, exactly what it was. But, you know, it was a comic book, so they had to do it in a comic book fashion. So every third page, you had to have this giant fight. We're not talking Speedy's addicted to whatever, cat crystals or whatever they had him on. This is like, you know, but, you know, the thing that comes up is, well, Cap, don't you owe all your superpowers to a drug? You know,
of course, yeah. So, you know, when you're addressing the war on drugs,
right,
it's important to completely forget that drug is such a generic term that it's almost like saying, well, you know, Doc, penicillin's a drug.
Well, and then in the last, literally,
mind blown.
Literally the last panel of the comic, okay, is Cap walking off into a doorway with Hank Pym, who they had to call Hank Pym in to cure Cap. Okay, so they did a giant blood transfusion to cure him, which took away his powers for a brief moment of time before, you know, they contrived that the super soldier serum had affected his DNA and created a way for him to be Captain America forever. But, you know, he's leaving and he's like, I don't need my old blood back, and I don't want it either. And they're like, you sure about this, Cap? And then the last line of the comic, right before the end, is, hey, if I can't just say no, who can? If I can't just say no, who can?
Indeed.
If you want to reference...
I think there's a lesson there for us all, and it has nothing to do with abstinence from drugs.
It has everything to do with Nancy Reagan, I think. But
or bad, you know, just say no to bad writing.
Right. And that aside, right, the writing is early 90s atrocious. Just amazing.
But I sense in this also the appeal for you is of the same species as the appeal that, you know, asylum films have.
It is after a fashion, but, you know, this is the other really interesting part about this book, is that upon buying the trade, which I found, which is actually fairly rare, but I think you can find it, you know, I read it again. It was different than I remembered it, because I read it when I was, a freshman in high school versus now. And now I'm reading it, and I'm like, this is A, awesome, B, hilarious, and see, I completely get what they were going for. And when you go online and research it, I've never seen a comic that was that wasn't like a Frank Miller, a comic that was meant to be shocking, be so galvanizing in the comic book community. People either love this or hate this comic, and the reason is the same, because it's so amazingly like bad that you have 50% of the people that absolutely love it. I mean, there is a scene where they fight between Red Skull and the Kingpin where they're down to their tighty-whities fighting. In Yankee Stadium. In the middle of Yankee Stadium, fighting in their tighty-whities. That's amazing. That is an amazing contrivance of comic books. That's so great. But my thing is, it's an encapsulation of what comics tries to do. And sometimes they do it really well, and sometimes they don't do it as well, depending on the parlance of when they're actually created, I think is a big part of it. And that's when they try to address a social issue and really yes. hit it head on. And, you know, the point of the comic is there. When you read it, you see it. But the way that they have to work around it, instead of just, like you said, saying drugs are bad, okay, or releasing it with a hostess, you know, a hostess ding-dong,
yeah.
is to create this massive, epic comic book that has supervillain fight scenes and underlying currents.
It's much like the creation of the characters Cloak and Dagger, which, you know, their genesis was that the mob were trying to create a cheap but highly addictive drug to get out on the streets.
Right.
and inadvertently created their own worst enemies, these young superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember somebody at the time pointing out, but Marvel, essentially, paraphrasing here, is sort of like, but Marvel, the mob did that. It's called crack.
Right, exactly.
Cheap to produce, highly addictive.
But, yeah, and I think the reason that I want everybody to read this is because it is so galvanizing. You know, there's something in this that you're either going to love or hate. And that's, I think, at the end of the day, we've talked about what comic books do really well and what comic books don't do really well. I think what if this book is that galvanizing, if that book has that kind of gravity that it pulls people in one way or another and they orbit it and they're willing to argue about it, and not just general internet arguing, but really kind of put a lot of thought into what it is and why it's there, there has to be something there that's worth reading. And I find it not only just enjoyable for the over the top, you know, bombastic nature of the art, of the writing, you know, get off my street, Jack, like stuff like that. Like, I'm like, okay. But also for the fact that it is so galvanizing, and it's like one of those movies you go see that everybody either loves or hates, you know, but you go see it anyway. And also it encapsulates everything that was right and everything that was wrong about 90s comic books. And yeah. I think that's amazing. So that's my suggestion is Streets of Poison, Captain America. That you can get it in collected, and you can usually get it pretty cheap at this point. So I would go find it or dig through the back issue bins. They're going to be about a quarter. So check that out.
Well, it's also one of those things that it's those little rare gems that in their own sense become all the more appealing.
Right. Right.
Because it does sort of speak of a time in comics. It's like finding a time capsule.
It is. It really
is. What were we thinking at that point in history? And it was sort of like all of the good intentions of, you know, Green Arrow, Green Lantern, with Speedy being discovered to be was like an opium fiend or whatever he was.
Right, like heroin, a cat
heroin
daddy,
thing, yeah.
Cat daddy or whatever he was on.
All of that good intention and pathos, or Harry Osborn hitting the pipe, but none of the poignancy.
Right.
And that juxtaposition itself is strangely beautiful.
It's kind of David Lynchian in its in its approach, and I absolutely love it. I think that it's well worth anybody's time. So, do you have any more?
I have one more that I sincerely hope that I'm not going to steal any thunder here, because it could easily fall squarely in your own wheelhouse here. And that is a book that you are responsible for me picking up, albeit at half price at a convention.
Hey,
because I couldn't find
any
damn Fables, I couldn't find any of the damn things I wanted at this place that had like 150,000 half price trade paperbacks.
Right.
I literally have never seen that many books in one place, and they were all on like these big rolling bookshelves, spines out.
Yes.
So there was none of that dicking around with having to, like, you know, index through thousands and thousands of books until you finally say, I don't care anymore.
Right.
And so absent what I really wanted to find, I thought, well, you know, at half price, I've heard nothing but good about this, and the art is outstanding. And that is a book that will be very familiar to Andy here, Saga.
Oh, love it. It's so good.
I got the
good.
First trade paperback of Saga.
So good.
And I fell in love with this book because it does something that is so very rare. It succeeds in that it tells a compelling story, at the end of which you find yourself perhaps asking, what in the flying hell was any of that about?
Right.
Because intrinsically, it's a damn good story that you don't know what the hell it is.
Right.
You know, there are elements there that are very approachable, but it thrusts you into a world that is so full of the unfamiliar. And it, to me, it does the tremendous favor of saying, I'm going to drop you squarely in the middle of a world you don't understand, and I'm going to trust that you can live in that world, and you can enjoy discovering that world without having all the minutiae explained to you.
Right.
In fact, nothing is explained to you.
Really, you are just launched.
And to me, oddly enough, and I'm very cautious about using this analog because I don't want to give the wrong impression, but to me, it felt like going and seeing Star Wars.
Okay.
Because you go in and there are familiar things. You know, if somebody pulls a knife or a sword, it's obviously a knife or a sword. It may have other features.
Right.
It may do something. But its intrinsic thing is, it isn't like someone pulls out something that looks like a big Bowie knife and it turns out to be some sort of communications device. And you're left thinking, okay, I guess your idea is, oh, look, made you think it was one thing.
Right.
I have ceased to care. So that, to me, it was very much like Star Wars because, you know, if somebody's walking around carrying a gun or you call those guys stormtroopers or this guy is tootling along in something that looks enough like a car that you know that it's a means of conveyance, you don't have to have someone come and explain to you why this is a hover-type car. That,
right.
You know, and you know, this is a desert planet where, you know, it's the same sort of idea. Everything is there. And it's up to you to draw your own conclusions or be to immerse yourself and allow this world to teach you itself.
Exactly. For me, Saga was that, but it also had this odd. Okay, so I'm gonna take your metaphor and extrapolate it. I'm gonna uncompound it a little bit. I'm gonna open it up. It would be to me as if Stanley Kubrick directed Star Wars.
I can get behind that.
Because you are left with all these familiar things, but you're left at the end of every at every beat, and every comic book beat that you would have, you're left just wondering what just happened. Like how is this tie into anything? What is this? There's enough familiar to keep me hooked in there, but everything else is so unfamiliar. You know, and I don't want to give any spoilers, but there's everything in this thing from talking cats to guys with TVs on their heads, you know, as heads, not even
as,
on,
yeah, as heads.
On their heads, as heads, to, like, weird guys with ram horns and space babies and all kinds of and you're just like, where am I?
Bat wings or people with insect wings.
Right.
People with horns or antlers or tusks or
robots, androids, talking animals. The whole, they're all bets are off. Nothing is safe.
Centipede humans.
Right, right. Not human centipedes.
And I'll tell you the other vibe I got from this. When I finished reading this thing, and I'm like, God damn it, now I have to go buy the next one. When I sat this thing down, what it invoked in me, I felt like I was 17. And buying Heavy Metal magazine at the grocery store because nobody gave a damn how old you were.
Right.
At the grocery
store. Right.
And you couldn't always get Heavy Metal magazine. Either the grocery store didn't always have it, or you couldn't always be at the grocery store by yourself to get it.
Right.
Which meant that when you found a story that you liked, that caught your attention, chances are you would be picking up a couple of issues in a row where you could follow the story, then you might lose a couple of issues. And you would pick up these familiar characters again with some gaps. And all those titties.
Right, just everywhere, titties everywhere.
Yeah. So this does have titties, so it has the prerequisites. This could have been slotted into Heavy Metal magazine in the 80s very comfortably, but for a slightly more modern vibe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this could have been written and produced and had everything about it, could have easily existed in Heavy Metal serialized in Heavy Metal two or three decades ago.
Right.
That is an interesting feeling, because I have not had that invoked in me since Heavy Metal.
Yeah, I know. I agree with that feeling. To me, it was like finding my dad's, and I'm imagining you're all thinking porn magazines, but it's not. It was like finding my dad's old, like weird or science fiction, the novels, the dime store novels that you would find and read, and just be like, what is happening? For a comic book to have that effect, it is mind-opening. And the fact that we're now relating that stuff into comic books, that almost like an emotional transfer, and we've got and it's so far away from the corporatization of what we're used to now, because everything is so die-cast, cookie-cutter.
Very much so. It's all sort of stamped out and ready to be kind of prepackaged.
Right. That having a book, and it's part of the image, the influx of image independent books, where they kind of went back to the basics of, all right, this is your property, you do what you want with it. And it was Brian K. Vaughan, isn't it?
I believe that is correct.
Yeah, so Brian K. Vaughan just knocks it out of the park. Just absolutely knocks it out of the park.
Yeah, and what's wonderful is it's telling this story in the moment while being narrated, essentially handed to you from its own future.
Right.
Because it's being narrated by a character who, intrinsically, you know exactly one character will have to survive to tell this tale. Yet, you know, you still are left wondering, what are the trials? What next twist and what turn? Where is this thing going to head? And that, to me, is what's really exciting, is going into the next trade paperback, is where do you go from here?
Right.
Because already this thing is chock-a-block full of... And what I really love also is it has that same sort of Star Wars sense of wonder in that, you know, you have these bizarre characters who then in themselves can be taken aback by things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's sort of like, how are you, from a very human standpoint, how is this creature so surprised by anything?
Right.
And that what that does is illustrate that these, to themselves, to those around them, they're not that bizarre. They're commonplace. They're common as mud. And then they encounter something that is outside of their realm of experience.
Right. Which puts us into an interesting standpoint, you know, an interesting perspective as the reader, when we enter a world where our linchpin, our anchor, is characters that exist in this world that don't know how to deal with the world that they're in, and that is very Star Wars too.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't know how to deal with sand people, how the hell are we supposed to know how to deal with sand people?
It's all well and good for the people of Tatooine, but what are we to do?
Right. Well, if Luke doesn't know how to deal with sand people, if he doesn't know that they walk single file to hide their numbers, how the hell were we supposed to know? You know, we're kind of thrust.
I might need to know that at some point. Obviously, Luke could have been well served.
So we're thrust into the confusion.
He fell for that whole ruse like a...
Right. So the hero, and it's very much the hero's journey, the Perseus, the Theseus, the Jason, you know, the Heracles, whoever you want it to be, we're thrust into the role of them very aptly and very adroitly by Brian K. Vaughan, where they're in this fantastic world, and they don't know what to do. So we're holding on to the coattails of the main characters, saying, where are you taking me? You don't even know where you're going, so I guess we're in this together.
Precisely. And that is, again, it's one of those things where what I call a thinking person's book, because one thing I just kind of irks me sometimes is it's like going to a movie that's that immersive. And somebody's like, oh, what's that? What's that? How's it? Like, shut up. Let it happen.
Right.
Go with it, dude.
Right. Just it. I forget the name of the comedian, Bill Hicks, life is a ride, enjoy it, you know, like just pick up your feet and float down the river with it. Don't try to fight against the tide, just let it go.
Exactly.
So, I have one more, and we are running long, but it is our 150, so deal.
Absolutely, yeah, we toyed with the idea of doing like a 90-minute or even a 2-hour show, and then decided that we need press asleep.
Right, but then again, you know, Cole and I can talk for a couple hours about comic books anytime. So all we did really was remove the limiter. Yeah. And my last one is something I think Cole, you've read this, and I think you will agree with me that it deserves its place in this in the upper echelons of comics. The best comics we've ever read, and I think it fits very aptly into everything we've talked about tonight, and that would be DC's The New Frontier.
Oh yes, absolutely.
The thing about this book is, I really love alternate history as a general kind of idea. I more so love the idea that now we can look back at the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and apply alternate history to continuity. So we've got all these stories of how the Justice League was formed, and the origin of the Green Lantern, and the Flash, and, you know, the fighting of Starro, and all these ideas that happened before. But what happens, you know, in between the raindrops? What happens where we don't see it? And this book encapsulates that as well as encapsulates the ideas that a guy, Darwin Cook, who, if you don't know who Darwin Cook is, he's an amazing artist. He's just an outstanding artist. And he's a very retro, kitschy, 1950s style, pin-up-y kind of artist.
Very much so, yes.
But you couple this idea with his art and his idea of the 30s, 40s, and 50s. So it's not a historian's take. It's not Ken Burns's DC, you know, secret history of DC Comics. This is a guy that would be not unlike Cole or I or any of you that decided that you wanted to do your take on what happened and did it, and we're allowed to do it. So it really focuses on some of the central themes of the time. It focuses on kind of the idea of, you know, the Red Scare. McCarthy era totalitarianism in the form of superheroes, where the unmasking of the superheroes is very important, you know, and you know, hiding. What are you hiding? You're a masked guy. What are you hiding? Which since then has become really prevalent in comics.
Yes.
It deals with racism. It's a little heavy-handed on the racism side, but it does deal with racism. We get a whole kind of story arc about John Henry, who survived a lynching and goes on to become, you know, Steel, with a giant sledgehammer and the hangman's hood and broken noose around his neck type of situation. But you also get some really interesting storytelling about John Jones. And yes. And Batman in their meetings and John Jones trying to infiltrate different, like, and becoming a cop. You get a really interesting story about Wonder Woman, which I thought was very cool.
Yeah, because what it does is it gives you your classic Golden Age DC universe.
Mm-hmm.
Your Earth 2 universe, if you will.
Yes.
If you want to kick it, you know,
old school
crisis,
right,
and gives you it allows an exploration of those sensibilities filtered through modern eyes and through modern storytelling, and it gives you some tales like, you know, how would we create that same, maintaining those sensibilities and creating that world, doing, you know, justice to that, the origins, yet retooling and retelling.
Right.
Without going bone claws, as it were. You know, you don't have to just completely retrofit everything.
Right.
And change absolutely everything. You can tweak it. And, you know, one of the things I thought was really brilliant about it is it even winked at the actual past of DC historically. And right. that is, there was a character in the Green Lantern, Hal Jordan Green Lantern mythos. This is actually kind of more like your Golden / Silver Age. Or your transition from the Golden into the Silver Age. In that there was a character that Hal Jordan is working with, an Asian character who he refers to as Moonface. And if I'm not mistaken, that character was from the early days.
Yes. Yes, it was.
And was blatantly called Moonface, but
yeah.
It was okay to playfully, you know, have this sort of playful racism.
Right. No, you're absolutely right.
And what I loved about that was they weren't afraid to acknowledge, yeah, we had a character called Moonface. But what they did was allow that character to stop being an archetype and start being a human being in the context of the story and take offense to being called Moonface.
Yeah.
And Moonface is given a name while being given a chance to be a person, an actual living, breathing character, and not what so many of the supporting cast in comics back in the 60s and the 50s and the 40s were little more than, you know, to take a term from role-playing, is kind of a non-player character.
Exactly. Exactly. The thing, the one thing that always stood out was kind of the Wonder Woman portion of the story arc, where she's in, you know, the Korean War era, Indochina, freeing the women slaves and arming them. And Superman comes to her and tells her that she's breaking protocol because superheroes aren't allowed to act without government sanction, you know. And she basically says, you know, are you going to stop me? Who's going to stop me? You know, I'm doing this. I'm doing an act of good. And that's sort of the underlying story arc, is that, you know, the superheroes have become demonized. The superheroes in this world that Darwin Cook has created have had to go underground with their superpowers and kind of hide from the law if they want to use them, or go civil war and become agents of the government. And in the end, what we see in true comic book, in true all good comic book fashion, is a threat greater than any of them comes down on them, and they have to go to task and come together, not under the banner of any one place, not under the banner of any one flag, and fight this thing and win. And, you know, so you're left with all this kind of real world gritty, and then not only real world gritty stuff like the racism and the kind of the pinko Marxism era, but you also get these weird psychedelic mind screws that happen in the Hal Jordan portions of it, you know, where he's traveling through different dimensions and he becomes the Green Lantern, and you got the stuff with the Flash that Darwin Cook does so well. He does kinetics so well that it's pretty great. You got this Kirby-esque, you know, Green Lantern stuff happening with, you know, with the colors and just the real kind of bright pastels and all that kind of amazing stuff happening. And in the same time, in the same page almost, you've got the kind of washed tones of, you know, the original Superman and the original Wonder Woman on there as well. And he just, and the stuff with,
but also
the,
Cook's style lends itself very well to telling this story. I don't think you could have had George Perez,
no,
or John Byrne or Frank Miller, anyone else, have the effect that that this particular art. This was very much art chosen to the story.
Right.
And much the way Dave Gibbons' art
yeah.
lends itself well to the Scottish comic. Which that will be referred to as the Scottish comic.
The Scottish comic tonight.
Tonight, just for tonight, because it will not be invoked.
And one of the really the coolest thing about it for me, as far as just a fanboy, right, was you had all your superheroes, but then you also had what was the name of the the name Rick Flagg's group?
Was it the Blackhawks that appeared? No,
it's the. The World War II soldiers, the Korean War soldier group. It was either the analog or the reverse analog of the Howling Commandos.
Yes.
And they were dropped. They were on a rescue mission and they got shot down.
I believe the Blackhawks appear in.
They do appear in it.
Yeah.
But you've got Sarge and Gunner,
the losers,
get shot down over a South Pacific island, and they're just and the storytelling is amazing because they get shot down over the South Pacific island. It turns out that the South Pacific island is populated by prehistoric creatures that before too unknown to the South Pacific island existed.
And in fact, that is like right out of that period of DC. There was the Dinosaur Island that I believe may have made its debut in Weird War Tales.
I think it did, but then
became folded into the greater DCU. I guess because dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs.
I love me some dinosaurs.
But the cool thing that they do is they don't tell it from the comic book, the normal comic book perspective, which is, oh, dinosaurs, let's escape, let's all escape, we all escape, or we'll fight dinosaurs and win.
Yeah.
They have to hide out, like, in caves underground and try to survive until help can come.
So it becomes almost like that, my history is extremely rusty to the point of falling apart.
Okay.
But there was a case of, I'm not even going to guess here, but there was a U.S. warship that was torpedoed, and a goodly amount, like half or more of the sailors were literally just sort of picked off by sharks.
Right.
Because no one knew, because their mission was so secret, no one knew that they were out there to get torpedoed in the first place.
Exactly.
And I think in a lot of ways, that's the invocation I'm getting. That's the vibe I'm getting is that same sort of idea where, when you're stuck on Dinosaur Island, you're just going to have to survive or get killed by it becomes, the man against man tale of war then becomes man versus nature.
But what they do so brilliantly is they show the human cost
yes.
of war through Dinosaur Island. Where you have scenes of like the guns, muzzle into the ground, and then the helmet on the gun, and outside of their cave, in their kind of burial ground, in their honorary, their ossuary, if you will, and the collection grows over time.
Yeah, it becomes almost like the literally in the Seven Samurai, where they're
yes.
literally ticking off. The circles.
That's exactly what it becomes.
Lost.
And it's very poignant, and he does a very good job with it. It's not the best, it's not the absolute best story that I could tell you to read like this, but it all folds together very well into a very enjoyable experience that explores some angles and some avenues and some corners of DC Universe that I think needed to be explored. And the art is second to none. That is absolutely true. And the storytelling is just—it's very poignant and it's very fun. And it's a area of comics that don't really get explored that often. So that's my last pick.
Well, I think we've explored a number of really good choices, and hopefully, in our expressing of why we find these to be such compelling, such highly recommended tales, we're inspiring listeners to seek them out, because that's really what I had in mind when we first introduced in our first annual, we had the best comic I ever read. because suddenly, you know, in conducting the interviews that we had and listening to the finished work, it was kind of a journey of discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were the idea behind this is to introduce you to things you may never have heard of.
Right.
And so often I've been in comic shops and heard people, you know, being advised or asking, well, what should I get? You know, I'm kind of keen to start. What's a good jumping off point? What are some, I just read this and this. What? And hopefully we're kind of piqued your curiosity or piqued your interest in some of the potential stories out there that struck a chord with us that resonate to this day.
Right.
These are the tales that we're going to seek out again and again. That, you know, much like the Scottish book.
Right. That we can pick up and read at a moment's notice and be satisfied.
Yes, and can continue to entertain to this day. So, if you happen to be inspired to check these out, and let us know, write to jcumail@yahoo.com. Let us know if you've tried any of these out, or if you are familiar and share that passion for these particular tales, or you know, if anyone could tell me what the hell happened with the Chimera.
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious about that as well.
Well, why don't you go ahead and plug us up? We'll get out of here. Guys, it's been an amazing 150-issue run. I never imagined going into this that this is what it would become, and I couldn't be happier that this is what it's become. And it hasn't, again, you know, we wouldn't be doing this on a weekly basis if it wasn't for the fact that you guys are out there listening. And you know, we do get feedback when we go to shows. We do get feedback in email and on Facebook. And you guys are as much a part of this show as we are. So keep it coming. We love ideas. We'll listen to ideas. We love to put you on the show. Let us know if you want to be on. Thank you. You know, that's the most heartfelt thing I can say is thank you all for 150 wonderful, weird, exciting, thought-provoking for us.
Taking comics in places you've probably never thought of, ironically, that we've never thought of.
Right. And
it sounds strange to say, but there are times where I don't know where these story arcs come from that I suggest, I'm sure. And
I feel the same way. Like, absolutely.
But why did I even think that? Why was that a thing? But there it is.
Right.
And we have more fun with it. And also I want to thank Andrew again. 150 issues, two annuals. We've got some big stuff coming up. Hey Kids Comics Quarterly coming up. Thank you for letting me be a part of this.
Are you kidding me? Thank you for being a part of it. Like this
has just been a very fulfilling experience. I have this show weekly. I have the Rancor Pit every other week, and the Rancor Pit Live every other week on top of that. I never would have imagined all those years ago on VaderCast where podcasting would lead me, but this has been one of those satisfying experiences because going in, I'm thinking, I don't read 0.5% of the comics you read.
Right.
By volume.
Well, yeah.
I am uniquely unqualified for this position. Yet, I began to see in myself exactly what you saw from the outset. And that is, there is an aspect of everything we talk about, because we weren't here to talk about what's on the racks today.
Right, right.
And what we need is that kind of mix of the knowledge of what's going on out there today with the old man brain on, you know, what's come before, and to provide two different bodies of experience and insight into everything.
I completely agree.
That's been just very satisfying.
Thank you, Cole, for not only being a co-host and a producer for the show for the past 3 years, but also for giving us a playground to play in, which is, you know, what you have done. You've given us the Jedi Cole universe, and that's a gift that that there you cannot, you can't put a price tag on, you can't put a sentimental value on. It's insane. So thank you for that.
That too has been a very satisfying experience. I had no idea what I was thinking of when I started it, and of course that does bring us to the point that we are coming to you through the Jedi Cole universe, which is the home of the aforementioned shows and anything else that happens to rattle out of my head. And that is, of course, JediCole.com. You can write to us the oft-invoked tonight, anyway, jcumail@yahoo.com. We do value all the feedback and all of the suggestions, and we would like to have some listeners on the show, some folks that we haven't heard from before. Because we haven't had a guest in a while.
Yes, about time.
You know, we are oftentimes producing this on the fly.
Yeah.
But you can, speaking of, you know, getting feedback at conventions, I, of course, run the Convention Awareness Project Texas, which is, for the last 3 years, we're rapidly approaching, entering the fourth year of bringing you listings of every single convention in the Lone Star State all year long. Another amazingly satisfying experience to see people who are all mentioned. It's like, oh, I use your site all the time. It's like, wow. You know, that's the highest compliment I can imagine, is just knowing that when people tell me, you know, I'm at this show because of your site, or I got to go to this thing I never would have known was going on, or this was on my, you know, I was in town and then looked up, and now there it was.
Right.
And that's what it's all about. I missed a lot of shows myself. I wish there had been something like this when I was first getting into it. So visit Convention Awareness Project Texas if you're keen on conventions in the state of Texas at cap-tx.info. We provided my BlackBerry will grace me with taking a charge.
Yeah.
Which it's eluding me right now. I'll be able to put some more video content up on the on Facebook, or not Facebook, on YouTube. I believe it's the Jedi Cole Universe or Jedi Cole Universe, something like that.
I think it's Jedi Cole Universe, yeah.
Jedi Cole Universe, and of course, I do periodically tweet on Twitter. If you can follow our Twitter feed at the Jedi Cole U.
There you go.
So check out all of those various things, and we will. There's so much more to come. We have this little sucker plotted out well into next year.
Yes, we do. All right,
and beyond, as we keep coming up with more stuff.
All right, let's let these guys get out of here and enjoy their day. So thank you all for listening, and join us next week for issue 151. We're back on the train, back on time. Our hiatus has ended. So join us next week for another issue of Hey Kids Comics, and say goodnight, Cole.
Hate us for being on hiatus.
They hate us for hiatus.
Don't hate us for being on hiatus.
That's good.
Because
hate is gonna hate us because we're the future, Charles, not them. Damn it. All right, say goodnight, Cole.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Ce qu'est l'amour. Comme les garçons et les filles de mon âge, je me demande quand viendra le jour où les yeux dans ses yeux et la main dans sa main, j'aurai le cœur heureux sans peur du lendemain. Le jour où je n'aurai plus du tout l'âme en peine, le jour moi aussi, j'aurai quelqu'un qui m'aime.